So I know you got a lot to do, and you got plans afoot and whatnot, but not to tempt you, but the baseball trip this year is to Missouri.
That's not too far of a drive. I've made that drive before, like, to see a Fish concert at one point, so it's a possibility.
Okay, it's a six-hour drive, so you know it's not really like Milwaukee or obviously your hometown, but you know, Kansas City, they got some good barbecue. I don't know what I'm going to be doing in St. Louis, but I got to be honest, it might feel a little weird because it's going to be the first one in 3 years where you're not there.
I have been to the Kansas City Stadium.
Okay.
I haven't been to St. Louis.
Well, you know, you got about 4 weeks if you want to throw together an impromptu plan.
Okay, yeah, no, it's not like I don't have anything else going on this summer, so yeah,
no, maybe. Not much. Welcome to Wherever You Are. I'm Ryan McNeil in Toronto, Canada, and you're listening to episode 117 of the Matinee Cast. It's the official podcast of thematinee.ca, your home for cinematic passion and perspective. Today, dear friends, I am joined by family, really. My guest today started out as just a voice on another show and became a friend across the blogosphere. And over the years, and really years now, there have been ideas bounced back and forth, emails galore, texts, tweets, listened to every episode of the guy's show, and shit, I crashed at his house about this time last year. It's family now. It's amazing what happens in the blogosphere where people who just start out as avatars and voices turn into really, really close friends. So today, I'm really excited because we're joined across a wire from Minneapolis, Minnesota, a place that I can attest is lovely this time of year, much to my surprise. But the host of the Row 3 Cinecast, one of the grand poobahs over at row3.com, it's Andrew James. How are you, sir?
Good, man. You just put a big smile on my face. I get all the warm and fuzzies when the podcasting community comes together and it becomes, like you said, family. So
it's cool.
It totally is.
I never would have guessed this when I first started doing this kind of thing. But especially, as I said, especially the people who, you know, I don't think of them as like internet friends anymore. It's like, you know, you're my friend again. I've crashed at your place. Yeah. You know. So
yeah, that made it official, pretty much.
Yeah, yeah. That was it. It's like giving me your class ring. On episode 117, we are going to be talking about Richard Linklater's Boyhood. We will be taking feedback on spoilers that did not spoil, but actually enticed your interest in the movie. And we'll be flipping over the record to play the other side. First, though, we need to learn more about Andrew. This is Know Your Enemy. Really and truly, this is Andrew's fourth appearance on the show, but the third appearance that happened during that staycation I talked about in Minneapolis wasn't a full-on show. We talked about some Coen Brothers movies, and we skipped past the Know Your Enemy. So he is taking the third-timer's questions, but before that, on episode 27... We learned that the first film Andrew had ever seen was Star Wars. The last film he'd seen at the time was a rewatch of The Social Network. The worst film he's ever seen is Silent Night, Deadly Night Part 2. The unseen classic or essential was Singing in the Rain, which he has since seen, and the movie he wished he'd made was 28 Days Later. Next, on episode 73, which is still quite some time ago, the film that everybody else hates that he digs is The Core. The film that everybody else likes that he does not is Bridesmaids. The last film at the time to make him cry was 50-50. In the movie of his life, Andrew James would be played by Kate Winslet, and the movie he was watching next was Something Wild. So, you now get to do the third-timer's questions as a fourth-timer. I don't think that's happened yet. Sir, what is the film that caused your love of film to turn a corner?
That's easy. Clockwork Orange.
How so?
Absolutely. It's still my favorite. I mean, besides Star Wars, that's my favorite film of all time.
Oh, how really? So? I didn't know that.
I mean, I watched a ton of movies as a kid, like we all did. But this was the first time I remember I was staying over to a friend's house, and his dad said, "You guys want something to watch? Watch this." It was banned in the UK. It's pretty out there. I think you guys will dig it. And I watched it, and it was the first time I watched a movie. And, you know, okay, it was banned, so maybe there's some boobs here, some good violence that I'm not supposed to be seeing. And there is that. But it was also the first time I realized that film can really be a quality work of art too. And it doesn't have to be necessarily artsy fartsy, but art. And I just really got into the weirdness of it, and yet how how well put together it was. It wasn't a schlocky B movie piece of shit. It was, oops, I'm sorry, I'm not supposed to
say that. That's fine. There's only two words I don't want you to say, and that's not one of them.
And it wasn't, you know, it's a really just everything about it, from performances to dialogue to direction. I just never seen anything like it. Still haven't really seen anything like it before or since. And it just blew me away. And from there on, I was more apt to maybe go to the rep cinema or the indie cinemas and see what else is out there besides the big, you know, explosions and action movies. And So I think I talked with... We did a full podcast on, what's the guy from Jamaica that does the podcast?
Oh, Andrew Robinson.
Andrew Robinson, right. We did a whole show on Clockwork Orange at one point a few years ago, and that was a lot of fun to talk about. So
I've totally forgotten about that episode. I'm going to have to go back and listen to that. Actually, it's kind of funny, not to digress in the middle of my own questions, but the thing I learned while at work yesterday is when you have friends that are podcasters and they're on each other's shows, it makes a boring day at the office a lot of fun.
Right. You totally.
Because it's like, oh, look, the circles are overlapping. This is great. How old were you when you saw this?
Have been, I was teenager. I mean, 16, 17, okay. Probably.
I don't think I saw that until I was around 19 or 20. And I think even the first time I saw it, I didn't quite get through it. I want to say the first time I saw it, it was after a night where I'd stayed up all night. So I was interested in everything like that, but I fell asleep in the middle of it.
Which I can see. I mean, it's long, it's kind of strangely paced, and it's very hypnotic.
Yeah.
Like, even though it's dark and crazy shit's happening, it's still kind of soothing in a weird way. So
Very cool. What was your first date movie?
Robert Downey Jr. in Chances Are.
What? Okay, I haven't even heard of that.
You haven't?
No.
Okay, so it starts in like the 50s, I think, 40s or 50s. He's just about to get married to, this guy's just about to get married to Cybill Shepherd. He dies. This is in the very beginning. He goes to heaven and is reincarnated as a youngster, but they forget to give him the shot that makes you forget your previous life.
Okay.
So he's reincarnated as Robert Downey Jr. in 1988 or whatever year I saw this. And he meets his daughter and falls in love with her and then realizes, oh, her mother is actually my wife from my previous life. And
oh, that sounds messed up.
It's a comedy. I mean, it's super fun. And Robert Downey Jr. is Robert Downey Jr. as a young guy.
I see.
And it's with Cybill Shepherd and Barry Lyndon, his name. I can't
Ryan O'Neill, isn't it?
Ryan O'Neill. And the daughter is the cute girl from Some Kind of Wonderful.
Oh, God. Okay.
I'm having one of those days where I can't remember anything.
It's okay.
The short blonde fried green tomatoes.
Shit. Mary Stuart Masterson?
Masterson.
There
yep.
we go. it was a long walk to get there, people. How'd the date go?
I think it went well. She was a year older than me and about a foot taller than me.
Nice.
So it was good. But it's actually a really great date movie. It still would be today, I think. It's really cute, really charming. And fun.
Well, maybe I'll make Lindsay happy and throw that one on, because that certainly sounds like something that's up her alley.
It feels a little John Hughes-ish in a way.
Okay. Okay. John Hughes-esque, basically, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
What's your sick day movie?
Well, that was a tough one to answer. Sick day has to be. It can't be too slow. It's got to be something to get my energy kind of flowing back into my body, but it can't be too funny because I don't want to be laughing, and it can't be something I have to think about too much, but it still has to be something I like, obviously.
Yeah, that's a lot of rules.
It is a lot of rules, which makes it a little bit tough, but Jumper is an easy one to throw on. That's another one that could be for the what's the movie everybody hates that you like. Jumper's one I really like.
I must admit, you're actually getting me wicked curious about Jumper. I've gone looking for it on Netflix a few times because I fully expect to be watching it going, what the hell is he on about? But so why Jumper then?
I don't know. Like I said, I mean, it's full of energy. It's a superhero movie that I think is unfairly shit upon. And I still don't totally understand it. And it's just got a lot of fun action sequences and good characters, but you don't have to think too much. It is pretty simple, kind of dumb. It just looks good. It feels good when I'm sick. It's just got the perfect vibe for me to watch.
Well, it certainly sounds like it fits the criteria. You want comfort on a sick day, right? Like you want something familiar and you want something that's, not to belabor a pun, but too like easy to digest. So that sounds like Jumper for sure.
And I think I could be wrong, but the director is Doug Liman, who did Edge of Tomorrow, and that'll be on a lot of top 10 lists, I think, at the end of this year. And if you go back and look at his filmography, like Swingers and Go and The Bourne Identity, there's a lot of good stuff in there. And I don't understand. And I think Jumper's in there, too. And I never have understood why everyone hates that movie so much.
All right. Well, I will make a concerted effort to finally give it a look.
All right.
What's the last film that's to leave you speechless?
Well, honestly, it was Boyhood. But we're going to talk about that. So previously to that, this is actually a hard question because I'm a movie podcaster. I always have something to say about a movie, Ryan.
Right.
But the honest answer is Captain Phillips, actually.
Okay.
When I came out of that movie the first time and was physically ill from the intensity of that last hour and didn't really have much to say, didn't really want to say much about it, right away. In a good way. I mean that in the best possible way. Captain Phillips is a fantastic film, but it physically made me speechless.
Did it have anything to do with that's a Greengrass movie, and those movies are usually really, really intensely shot. Like there's a lot of handheld work, that kind of thing. Did that have anything to do with it, or was it just what we're seeing in that last hour?
Yeah. It had nothing to do with the visuals themselves. It was all about what was going on, and particularly the last 5 minute portrayal there from Tom Hanks.
Oh sure, the last 20 minutes or so, when it's that Navy SEAL team trying to have their take out the operation. That's an intense bit of cinema.
It's an amazingly intense bit of cinema. They're trying to get the three guys on target to get Green. I mean, it's really well done. So. Yeah.
No, yeah. I could see that for sure. Did you see that on your own?
Yeah, I was there by myself.
Yeah, because sometimes it's kind of crazy. Like, if you see a movie like that on your own, you kind of want somebody to be there with you. Like, again, kind of like the comfort food of Jumper. You kind of want somebody to be there afterwards to go like, so that was crazy, huh? That kind of thing. I find sometimes if I see that kind of movie alone, it's almost worse.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, in this case, if somebody had been next to me, I would have just been like, I don't even want to talk about it right now. Let's just get in the car and then give me a few minutes this one,
Yeah, I gotcha. Finally, what is your what's a line from a film or such that would be your epitaph?
Before I answer that, let me give a shout out. I don't know who the guy was. I can't remember. He was on your show maybe a year ago, and he mentioned, "We really shook the pillars of heaven, didn't we, Wang?" Whoever that guy was, what a great answer. I thought that was from Big Trouble in Little China. So I want to give a shout out to that guy. I can't remember who it was, but...
Was it Brian Rowan? Part of the thing is I only have so many three-time guests.
I know.
I feel bad that I don't know who his answer that was. I'm going to say that was either Brian or it might have been Andrew, actually.
So if you're listening, dude, good call.
Gotcha.
But mine is actually, it would be this: be excellent to each other, and party on, dude.
Now the funny thing about the one for Big Trouble in Little China is that was the only one so far that I have not yet recognized. I do love that a lot of people are choosing some really, really clever lines for this kind of thing, and not clever in a Cameron Crowe or Woody Allen kind of way. Like they're choosing stuff that's just almost like throwaway lines from fun movies. Like the one I keep coming back to is the first person to answer this question was Mariah Gates down in Los Angeles, and hers was "Good Times Noodle Salad" from "As Good as It Gets." And I really think all you guys that are choosing these kinds of answers, and certainly from Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, which if people don't know, that's where yours is from. You're doing it right. Is what I'm saying. If I saw that either like on an actual tombstone or in a program at a funeral, I'm like, yep, that's about the size of it right there.
And I really do try to live my life by those words, and it wouldn't be totally disingenuous to have that quote on the on the tombstone, and then right below it, Abraham Lincoln.
Of course.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. I was watching Lincoln the other day, and I was waiting for him to say the line.
Right.
I was disappointed when he didn't.
Damn it.
Right? I'm like, what's going on? How's he dead already? Oh, spoilers for Lincoln, I guess. Well, there we go. That's more about Andrew. We're going to learn more about you folks right after this. It's your chance to come talk to me after this break. Why are you shaking like a leaf? Come on, come talk to me. For episode 115, which was momentarily interrupted by the Begin Again episode, which dropped as 116, I asked people about the nature of spoilers, because I got an email from listener Bubba Wheat from Flights, Tyson Movie Nights, who's actually going to be the guest on the next show. But he was talking about our episode where we discussed How to Train Your Dragon 2, and how when Matt Brown and I got into the very, very spoilerific conversation surrounding How to Train Your Dragon 2, it actually made him want to watch the movie more. So that got me thinking, has that ever happened to anybody before? Has there been a spoiler conversation that has made somebody want to watch a movie more? And I didn't get a whole lot of answers on this, but I got a few good ones. Andy Hart from Fandango Groovers in England said, it's never happened to me, but I will go off on a bit of a tangent. I have never seen The Crying Game, as someone gave away the twist to me. I've been given a copy on VHS. Yes, I still watch videos. Props to that, dude. So we'll probably watch it one day, but on a similar topic and related to your discussion, I have never liked The Sixth Sense, probably because I saw the twist coming. On the other hand, I also saw the twist coming in The Village, but liked it regardless. My favorite Night Shyamalan movie is Unbreakable, where I didn't see the twist coming, but rewatching it now, I can't believe I didn't catch it. Friggin' Shyamalan now is kind of a meme unto himself where it comes down to spoilers, right? Like, it's anytime he's got a movie coming out, you're almost like, okay, how does this have a spoiler that I can give away?
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, what's the twist? Everybody's just waiting for the twist, which actually makes it not a twist anymore.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, there's that. Exactly. As for The Crying Game, have you ever seen that, The Crying Game?
I have.
Yeah. I just watched it for the first time this year. And even knowing, like, first of all, I'm watching it. I'm like, how do people not know this?
Okay, it's funny that this is your first email. I was going to wait till the end, but okay, that's actually my answer too.
Okay, well, you know what? In that case, we'll get back to it then.
Okay, yeah, we'll come back to it.
Cool. All right, so so thanks, Andy, for the email. On Facebook, Red George said Zombieland certainly intrigued me. Its cameo was spoiled for me about a week before, and then I had to watch it.
Totally.
Yeah, that was one where, like, I think that came out the week before I got married, so I really didn't have time to go watch movies. And, yeah, there was just no getting around that cameo. The internet was just abuzz with that one showing up. And yeah, like, that was the kind of, I think I was just, I was so on it, but as soon as that information came down, I'm like, well, I'm seeing it now for sure.
Yeah, I feel like, I mean, it's not a plot spoiler, really. It's just like, I'm not really interested in this. But oh, he's in it?
Yeah.
Or she's in it?
Yeah.
I'm down.
Yeah. See, now, I got another comment about a cameo, which it's far, far lower, but I might as well get that out of the way now. Sophia from Film Flare, and she is on the Across the Universe podcast with Nick and Matt. She mentioned John Hamm's cameo at the end of The A-Team. Which is more of a throwaway moment, but you know, if you're a fan of John Hamm and somebody says, "Hey, he shows up at the end of the movie," I was like, "Yeah, you probably go."
Yeah, sure.
So yeah, I guess a good hearing about a good cameo could probably draw you in.
I think so. I mean, that's totally because I think a plot spoiler, you would think, oh well, that's, I don't need to see it now.
Yeah,
but a cameo, it's some, you know, whether you're a completionist for somebody's filmography or you just really like a certain actor. Yeah, I can totally see where all of a sudden your interest is piqued now in whatever movie it is. Yeah. Totally.
My friend Jess Rogers on the other side of the river said, once I knew what was going on with Cabin in the Woods, I was dying to see Whedon's creation. That's a big one, because for that one, for the longest time, like that's one that there was lore around that movie. Like, it was this one that just wasn't getting made and was sitting on a shelf, and nobody really seemed to know what it was. So I think the moment, and then when that movie dropped, like, the conversation quickly turned to, it's not what you think it is. Because all like none of the ads really gave a clue right. as to what that movie was, right? So I think as soon as people started saying it's not what you think it is, the die was cast for that one.
There's the poster, so it's clearly a puzzle, and the trailer was a little weird, but it absolutely you're right. It never shows its ace up its sleeve or whatever in any of the marketing. And when you finally sit down and it starts revealing all of its cards, it's really a thing of its own.
Like
I think.
Right away too. I got to give that movie props. It kept all that stuff away from the marketing.
Oh
and then,
yeah.
And then first scene, it's like, you know, here's what we're doing. Oh shit. That's what you're doing. Holy crap.
Yeah. The two guys in the office talking yeah. And you still, even at that point, you're like, okay, this is something clearly not what I was expecting, but I still don't really get what's going on.
Yeah.
And it takes a while to get through all that.
Yeah. Yeah. Matt Kowalski, speaking of Across the Universe, said the spoiler is all I know about The Sixth Sense, and it really intrigues me. What happens before it? What falls in sir of the movie? Why is it such a surprise? I get the feeling that she actually hasn't seen it, so maybe it's a blind spot for her that she's going to do this year. Enjoy it, Matt. That's the thing about that movie, right? Of course, because now it's just become about the ending.
Yeah, that's all it is. I mean, it's just like. It's the spoiler ending that everybody knows, yeah. right? It's just like Darth Vader and whatever.
Yeah.
And I'd be fascinated to see somebody who's never seen the movie but knows the end write a piece on what they think of it now. Yeah. And do you watch the thing going, oh, this is so telegraphed. It's so obvious.
Well, that'll be like the second time watch for all of us, right? Like that was the thing about that movie. That was why that movie was such a success was everybody went back to see it again saying, okay, yeah. now I want to see if I can see it.
Right, exactly.
So, cool. On Twitter, Sean Kelly, who tweets as SK on Movies, said, I absentmindedly watched an episode of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which directly referenced Captain America the Winter Soldier. Even though I was annoyed that revelations from the film were spoiled for me, I was intrigued to see how that played out. That's one, like, you know, I almost feel for Sean on that one because you would think... You don't expect a crossover from a movie into a television show, even one that's as intrinsically tied as Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah, I don't know much about that spoiler, but I remember hearing people talk about it. I think that night, actually, a bunch of people were saying, or I don't know, I saw it on Twitter where a bunch of people were saying, don't see Captain America until you've seen this, or vice versa, something like that.
It was the other way around. What happened, I've never seen this before, is the events that happened within Captain America were directly referenced 3 nights later, like on the Tuesday after opening weekend on that week's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
That's right. Yeah.
So, like, talk about, holy crap, you got to be... Like, I guess they know their audience, because if you're watching Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., you're going to the Marvel movie that weekend.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably. But yeah, they directly referenced what was going on. And it had a huge turn to their particular plot. Like the plot of the whole season turned in that one episode. So, you know, you kind of got a feel for Sean because on the one hand, you can sort of see something like that coming. But on the other hand, you don't expect something to be that interwoven.
Now, are you watching that show?
I've got like 10 episodes on the PVR, but I can't seem to actually get up any kind of momentum with it. There's too many good shows on right now.
Yeah, that's how I feel. And I've heard mediocre at best reviews for
it. Got better, but I was just kind of watching it in spite of myself at the beginning, and around the time it got to Winter Soldier, I started watching it with much more interest. It got better at its end. I'll be curious to see if it can kind of gain some momentum in its second season, but I wasn't really tuning in out of a whole lot of love. A few more comments. Candice LePage, who is up in, I want to say she's in Kitchener, Ontario, or London, Ontario, one of those, said, she's another one, said The Sixth Sense is a film I only wanted to see after I was spoiled about the twist. My friend Rachel Thoreau said many times, but the one that sticks out is The Mist. I read the ending and thought, no way, and had to see it to believe it. I've never seen The Mist.
Oh, really? It's really good.
That's, you know, okay.
It's really good. And it's don't
okay.
Don't get this, just watch it.
Okay. I won't read about it. I was actually just about to say, okay, so what happens? But I'll let it go then.
Have you read the book? Are you a Stephen King fan? Okay. The book ends differently than the movie, and I think the movie ends better.
Okay, I'll give it a look then. I got a new comment from a follower on Twitter named Joe Iani, who tweets as Tiny Enemy Shrimp. He read an interview with someone whose character dies in Casino Royale before he saw it. Spent the whole film waiting and wondering. There's not a whole lot of death in Casino Royale. So no. The fact that that character gave it away, I feel kind of bad. And finally, James Blake Ewing, who tweets a cinema site, said, I read about a lot of films in school. I watched because I knew crucial details about them and they sounded intriguing. It happened so many times that I don't even remember what films I had spoiled for me going into them. Rarely it affects my enjoyment. That's the one thing I'm actually really happy about, that I don't have a film studies background, is they don't always just drop you into the movie and then discuss and analyze after. A lot of times there's a long preamble or a lot of assigned reading to go with the film mm-hmm. you're watching. So I can only imagine how that would probably suck a lot of the fun out of it.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right, so they stop in the middle of the movie and let's talk about this for a minute and then we'll go back to it. Yeah.
No. I want to keep going. Come on, man. Okay. So you said The Crying Game.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Tell me about that.
Well, mine's a little bit unique in that the reason the spoiler intrigued me is because the spoiler is in the credits of, I think it's Hot Shots Part 2. So if you sit and watch Hot Shots Part 2, at some point in the credits, it says, just randomly in the middle of the credits, it says, the secret to The Crying Game is this. And instantly I said, oh, well, that's hilarious. That I've never heard of that before. A movie deliberately giving away a spoiler for another movie. And Hot Shots Part 2, that's like 1990, maybe?
It's around the same time. It's like, it might be, I don't know if it's the same year, but like it might be the summer after.
Yeah, and that was what made me want to see it. Not so much I was intrigued at the movie. I was intrigued with, why would another movie give away the end of this movie? So I got to see it. And I did finally see it, and I literally remember nothing of that movie. I know I saw it. I remember not really caring for it very much, but I couldn't tell you outside of that spoiler. I know that clearly in my head.
Okay.
I don't remember the movie at all, but you saw it this summer, huh?
Yeah, I saw it a month or two ago. I saw it, and first of all, it holds up really well. Like, aside from the twist, it's a really good movie.
Just
regardless of that. Miranda Richardson is just killer in that movie. Forrest Whitaker, you just feel terrible for him the whole time. I totally get Stephen Ray now as a like how like his whole career, and it even with like the only funny thing is just watching the movie and knowing that in the back of my head, I'm like, this is such an obvious plot point. How could it catch anybody off guard? But I guess in the thing I'm thinking of myself is, in 91, queer culture wasn't quite as prevalent in mainstream culture.
Right.
So the idea that he's in the wrong bar and the idea that, you know, somebody is cross-dressing to that extent, it's like, oh, shoot. Well, okay. So and don't get me wrong. Like, I can't remember who it is that plays the trans character, you know, makes a pretty hot chick.
I need to rewatch it because I have a feeling like, now, just a little older and a little more mature, I think I'll like it.
Maybe. I'm pretty sure it is on Netflix. Well, my answer for this, I think I might have watched it the same week as The Crying Game, actually. It's a movie that I just watched this year, even though I knew the big ending scene for a long time now, because I found out about the ending scene, and that was like, oh, got to see it now. It's The Cook, The Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover.
Oh, it's been in my Netflix queue forever. I haven't gotten around to it.
Oh, so okay. So the thief is Michael Gambon, and his wife is played by Helen Mirren, and she's having an affair. That's where the lover comes in. And Gambon owns a restaurant, so every once in a while, in the background, you've got the cook. Gambon finds out about the affair. That's, you know, you know that he's going to find out about the affair after like a moment or two. It's not really that kind of rocket science. And what he does about it is understandable for these characters. It's certainly not understandable in general, but that's not the end of the story. The end of the story, like the wife has her comeuppance in the end. Like, she's takes the last scene and she basically just takes control of the whole thing. So I found out how she takes control of the whole thing and how she kind of has her say with this scoundrel thief who's been just giving it to her the whole movie. And first of all, like it was pretty damn disgusting when somebody told it to me. I was like, oh God, I can't believe I'm going to see that. But at the same time, I'm like, well, shit, I got to see that. And there was that. And just the whole idea of it, of this kind of dirty crime movie set in a really, really gourmet restaurant. But the moment I found out what the comeuppance is, I didn't realize it was the last scene. That's the only reason why I'm being vague about it now, is because it's the very last scene. I thought it was somewhere in the middle when I found out about.
So it has something to do with your sort of sick mentality to see something.
Yeah.
Nasty.
Yeah, that's I'm like, come on. I was like, I don't know how I'm going to be able to. Oh, but I still got to see it. So that was mine. When I found out about the comeuppance in the cook, the thief, his wife, and her lover, I thought, I need to see this movie. Otherwise, it just would have been one of those arty movies that, you know, got described all the time when I was younger. But that's mine. So I believe it's also on Netflix Instant. So if you want to see what the hell I'm talking about, give that one a look.
Yeah, it is. It's in my queue. Now okay. I'll have to watch that okay. sooner rather than later.
There we go.
Awesome.
Well, for the next episode, my question has nothing to do with the feature review that we're going to be talking about, but it does directly tie into the fact that I've been spending the last week or so watching far less movies because I've finally been tearing through the Fargo TV series. Did you watch that, by the way?
I watched like two or three episodes.
And then you bailed?
I do plan on going back.
Okay. I'm kind of like that with shows sometimes. It's like, yeah, it's there waiting for me, especially a show like Fargo, which is self-contained. Like that's a really good thing for a rainy weekend. But getting it's not a direct lift, but getting the idea of a movie being turned into a 10-part or 8-part miniseries, kind of like what we've seen with Fargo and to an extent with True Detective. I wanted to know, what movies would you like to see made into a 10 or 12 part television show on HBO or Showtime or FX or AMC? What would you like to see? Tell me a story, a movie that you want to see stretched out into 10 or 12 hours. Ryan@thematinee.ca, Twitter, where I'm matinee_CA, or Facebook, facebook.com/darkmatinee. We are going to be right back after this to talk about a film I'm very excited about. It's probably my most anticipated movie of 2014. It's Boyhood, The New Slang, right after this. Look at the stars. Shine for you, and everything you do. Yeah, they were all yellow. Boyhood is written and directed by Richard Linklater. It stars L.R. Coltrane, Lorelei Linklater, Patricia Arquette, and Ethan Hawke. It is the story of a divorced couple, Mason and Olivia, raising their young son, Mason Jr., and his sister, Samantha. Over the course of 12 years, we first meet Mason and Samantha when Mason is 6 years old in the summer of 2001, and it follows them through his graduation of high school at age 18. To paraphrase the writing of the Coen brothers, sometimes there's a film. Well, it's the film for its time and place. It fits right in there. Film can sometimes play as escapism or imaginative trifles, but sometimes a film can actually serve as a signpost for the generation that spawned it. Boyhood is one of those movies. It begins in 2001 and encapsulates so much of what life in these last 14 years have been about for boys and girls. But what about those of us who are already of age by the time the millennium arrived? So, pop quiz hotshot. If one did not grow up in this century that we're in, what does Boyhood have to say for them?
I think this movie transcends any zeitgeist of the modern age. I feel like this movie could absolutely be a story that takes place in the 50s and it would be just as relevant. It could take place even in the 20s and it's just as relevant. Yeah, there's video games and phones and technology and stuff in here, but I think this is a movie that everybody, just about everybody I know can relate to, at least certainly in America or Canada. And that includes, it's not just a boy story.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of stuff in here for the ladies too, to really get at. And the reason part of the reason I say that is, throughout the course of this movie, it's almost 3 hours, or it is 3 hours long, I think. There will be tears. But what's interesting about it is those tears are going to come at different times for different people. And I remember sitting in a packed theater watching this movie, and there would be people crying, you know, fairly early on, 45 minutes in or so. Then some other people, I could hear it, you know, behind me, some sniffling, an hour and a half in. For me, it happened at, I don't know, maybe the 2.5 hour mark. I think there's something in here for everybody to relate to.
It's kind of crazy because that was it was really, really hard for me to tune this movie out for the 6 months or so since it premiered at Sundance, because it showed up. I know it showed up in Sundance. I want to say it showed up in Berlin as well, the Berlin Film Festival. You guys were talking about it after you saw it at the Minneapolis Film Festival in May.
April or May,
April,
yeah.
Right? So not to mention, like, you know, just a million and one pieces that have been written about this thing as it's been going along. It's been really hard for me to keep everything at bay and trying to go see this thing as clean as I could. But one thing that started to trickle through in the last week were the suggestions that if you were not a boy of a certain age or a father of a teenager, that it might miss the mark. So that was my first kind of warning going into this movie. Is this going to miss the mark for me? Is its entire audacity and whatnot just not going to land because the story is not latching on for me? But like you say, it's not. First of all, it's generational in the way that it talks about life in these last 14 years. But you're right in saying that it doesn't just talk about it from a boy's perspective, and it really doesn't even talk about it from the perspective of a young person. It just talks about life in general. Mm-hmm. The one of the crazy things is, in certain respects, the boy Mason Jr. is not always at the forefront of his own damn story. It's very much just as much about Ethan Hawke and Arquette as it is about him.
Yeah,
Arquette especially.
When I mentioned the part I cried at, it was a moment of clarity or whatever, or a turning point for Patricia Arquette's character.
Right.
Actually. So, yeah, I mean, that said, it will definitely, I feel like, strike a little bit stronger chord with men, you know, whether you're a teenager or in your 20s or 30s or 40s, it is a little bit stronger for the men, but yeah, I mean, it is very much the parent's story, just as it is, Mason's story, definitely. Yeah.
Now, so obviously you dug it.
I anticipate this being my favorite movie of the year. It's
really
right on top, number one. I don't see it slipping.
Okay. What was it about it that really, really just like hit home for you?
Man, where to start?
Yeah.
To me, it's just perfect in every way. Like, well, first of all, the fact that just the craft itself, which, I mean, we can get into, that it is, I don't think I've ever seen a movie that's shot over the course of 12 years, 11 years, whatever, and keeps the same characters. That's astounding all in itself. Even if the movie didn't really work out that well, I think that would be something to applaud and to be really excited about, that he was able to keep these guys. Like, it could have been an absolute disaster. I feel like this was an experiment, and it just happened to work perfectly.
Can you imagine if he'd got 3 or 4 years in or 5 years in and thought, yeah, shit, this just ain't working?
Yeah. What?
If something happened to one of the kids?
Yeah. What if the main character died, got in a car accident or something terrible like that? Or would you keep going and say, that's part of life? I don't know. Like, it's a hell of a gamble to start this movie. Not only for Richard Linklater, but like, think about, what if you were however old this kid is, what, 8, 7 or 8, and a guy says, we're going to make a movie and it's about you, and this is going to take up the next 12 years of your life, and I'm going to show up every year for a few days and we're just going to focus on you. I mean, that, for a little kid, that's pretty heavy, I think, especially with all these stars and Linklater directing.
Well, you know, the thing that I think actually works in his favor is, the one thing that started going through my brain watching this movie is the Up series.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Well, but here's the thing. Here's where this kid wins that the kids in the Up series had it harder, is the Up series just shows up every 7 years and does its thing and releases itself out into the world and then lets it go and comes back every 7 years. This, at least the kid had a chance to grow, had this happening to him, like, and he was a part of it for his entire childhood, but he doesn't have to deal with it until now. And now he's old enough to deal with it.
Yo, totally. That's a good point.
If he had to deal with this going along every year for 12 years, this kid would be messed up.
Yeah, I know Matt Gamble on our show is a big, huge fan of the 7-Up series. And one of the things he talks about all the time is how the stars, for lack of a better term, of that series, a lot of them really don't deal with the celebrity status that they have. I mean, as low key as it is, like, they don't like to be approached and stuff. And yeah, with this, nobody had any clue who this kid was until now.
Yeah, and it's the same sort of idea. Like, the crazy thing about this movie, and the really crazy thing about this movie, is that not a lot happens. The plot summary on Wikipedia is literally 3 lines long. It's a kid who grows up, and the story of him and his family. And things come and go in and out of his family the same way that they would any family over the course of 14 years. There's no gigantic inciting incident. There's no moment of high drama. It really, like, it almost could be a documentary.
Yeah, almost. But it is clearly, you know, written.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, that's part of, goes back to saying that it is for everybody, because it's the type of stuff, it's life. Life. It's such a true coming of age film. I don't think I've seen too many coming of age films that are this true to itself. Everything is so earnest, in the best possible way. And the things that are talked about, and the things that happen to him, I know people that stuff like that happened to.
Yeah.
Or like, things like just the little things of him and his buddy getting a Victoria's Secret magazine or the Sears catalog and pointing at the ladies in bras and giggling, and like, that's real. Yeah. And it's captured so well on screen.
Yeah, that's the great thing, is like both the great things and the terrible things that happen in this movie. Like, you know, so Olivia is front and center in this movie because over the course of the movie, like, she starts out and we know that she's got a failed relationship with Mason Sr. That's Ethan Hawke. After a little while, she moves on and she's dating one of her profs from university, and they get married, and then that doesn't work out in, like, spectacularly bad fashion. And then she marries again and that doesn't even work out. So on the one hand, you've got somebody who just can't seem to find the right person. And I don't know about you, but I know people like that.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, so as much as it is about this kid and the, you know, a lot of times the great things that are happening to him growing up, and a lot of the painful things too, it's about the mom as well, and the crappy things that she's going through. And we've met this kid, we've met that mom, we've met Mason Sr. as the pseudo deadbeat dad who kind of wants to try again. It's all so tangible.
There are things, physical items throughout the movie that you sort of latch onto to make it even more tangible.
I mean, sure.
The video games is clearly a recurring motif.
Yeah.
And it keeps, not only does it keep you grounded as to sort of the time period that we're in. Oh, okay, we've advanced a couple of years now. They're playing Xbox instead of Nintendo 64 or whatever. But it also, it gives you something to sort of relate to.
Like,
I know this. And yeah. So I love the idea of telling us when we are based on the video games that he's playing.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty much it. Yeah, like, haircuts change and stuff like that. But I think the video games, and there's cars too in the background, and cell phones, that really just say, oh, okay, now I know kind of the time period that we're in.
Well,
rather than a title card that says 2 years later.
Yeah, I was, and that's the thing, I was waiting for those. I was waiting for, like, you know, a calendar to come up or something like that. The funny thing for me is what was marking the time for me was the soundtrack. The soundtrack is sequential. Like, they use very, very prominent songs from the years that they happened, and the soundtrack happens in sequence. And the music nerd that I am, I'm pretty well versed with what was playing when. So every once in a while, if I was a little unclear, you know, Lady Gaga would come up or Phoenix would come up and I'd be like, oh, we're in 2006. You know, like it was kind of a great little refresher.
Did you find any of the music a little too on the nose?
Only in the beginning. There's a moment in the beginning where they're riding the bikes and I think it's The Hives comes on and it didn't really seem to suit the moment, but a lot of the other times the music seemed to work its way in pretty naturally. Like they're playing pool in a bar and there was a song playing, and you know, if you're playing pool in a college town in a bar on a Saturday night, it's this kind of song that's going to be on, you know. And we forget that they spend half this movie as like 13-year-olds or younger, and they're going to be listening to the pop music. When you're that age, you're not really going in for like the indie kind of stuff. You're really going for the biggest stuff at the time. So yeah, you know, the little girl would be singing Britney Spears.
Exactly.
So
what a great scene.
Yeah, that was cool. Well, speaking of, how much did they luck out with these kids?
Oh, they're so good. And that's one thing we can talk about as performances, is because the first, I don't know, maybe 10 or 15, maybe 20 minutes for me did feel a little bit off. These kids aren't that great.
You're saying it's going to be a long 3 hours.
Yeah, I'm like, I don't know what this. And then Ethan Hawke shows up and really, really injects a lot. Like this guy who knows what he's doing in the acting department, definitely has some feel for Richard Linklater's style and maybe his vision and everything. He comes along and really injects a lot of heart and energy into it. And then once you get past that first hurdle, like the first year or whatever, yeah, I think the kids really start to understand what they're a part of and what they're supposed to be doing and kind of the vision. And they really nail it. Again, it could have been a disaster. Like, you're just pulling this kid out of nowhere. What if he was just a terrible actor?
Yeah.
And it turns out he's amazing.
Yeah.
And his
both of
daughter.
Them, like, and both of them kind of grew up pretty well, too. Like, you don't really know what they're going to look like at age 17 and 18, especially the boy. Like, frig, mm-hmm. Think about what you looked like at 18.
Yeah.
You know, you really don't, and 17 and 16, you really don't know what you're signing on for to put the kid in front of a camera when he's friggin' 7 years old. But that's the thing. I got to give credit on this one. I went to see the movie with a friend of mine locally named Mike Lane, who some of the locals might recognize his name. And we were talking afterwards and we were saying, as the movie goes on, like with each subsequent year, the scenes seem to get longer and longer and longer. So by the point you're in his senior year and his summer leading into college, it feels like that takes about 45 minutes. And I got to believe what Mike suggested, and I believe that it's true, is as these kids grew up, Linklater realized he could get more from them. He could have deeper conversations about what they wanted to do. He could rehearse differently and, you know, just out of sheer maturity.
Yeah.
Oh. But
without a doubt, yeah.
Yeah, but again, you get lucky there. Even with one of them being your own daughter, you get lucky there in that they grow into it. Because again, both of these kids could have said, "I don't really want to do this anymore."
Yeah, I don't know if they were under any kind of contract or what. But and in terms of like you, I think you kind of alluded to it, like physically what they look like.
Yeah,
I love that he does have kind of an awkward phase, like we kind of all do.
Oh yeah.
When you're going through that era, and then he kind of matures into a pretty good looking kid.
Yeah.
And so it makes it all more believable when, you know, his girlfriends later on are extremely attractive.
Yeah.
And I don't know, it just makes it more entertaining, I guess, in a movie kind of way. You know what I mean?
Well, because he's also a kid who's got stuff going on for him. Like, I think if we'd watched, and I don't think that Linklater ever would have written something like this, but if we had watched 14 years in the life of a kid who grows up to be the starting quarterback, I don't really think it would have been all that interesting. Or the friggin' prom king. I really don't think it would have been that interesting. But the fact that he turns into this artsy, really smart, kind of outsiderish kid, artist, I think is really what makes the movie work.
While you're watching him, you do almost feel like a big brother or a parent or something, where you just have this weird sense of optimism for him. You really want him to succeed. You know, there's scenes where it's a possibility he's going to go down kind of a negative road and maybe really get into drugs or alcoholism or do something really bad. And you're just rooting for him. Like, don't make the wrong decision here. Be the kid that you can be and grow into the man that you should be. At the same time, follow your dreams and be artsy and whatever and be yourself. But I feel like I've never had that kind of a relationship with a character before.
No. Well, because we watch him grow. He's very much like a nephew. He's like a son. He's like a younger brother because we watched him age. Freaking four, what was it? Sorry, 12 years we watch him age? That's insane.
Yeah.
So it is.
It's insane. And I don't feel like I'll ever have a character like this again that I'll be so attached to in this way.
No, of course not. Did you feel the length?
Not at all.
You gotta applaud that kind of thing because I don't know about you, but when I saw the runtime on this, I was like, whoa. I was still going. Like that does not deter me in any kind of way. I'll take that challenge. I'll eat it and smile. But I was really, really surprised at how brisk this 2 hours and 45 minutes is.
It feels like 110.
Yeah.
It's so breezy. Because you're just enthralled at every moment. Even when they're just sitting around talking about stuff, it's such really insightful and really kind of inspiring, some of it, and really relatable dialogue.
Totally.
I love the conversations that Ethan Hawke has with them.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's talking birds and bees or just talking about, life in general and how to get through it all. It's so great, especially when he gets older. And they're able to have a little bit more mature conversations.
Oh, totally, totally, and even the hard conversations that Olivia, the Patricia Arquette character, has to have with him because like there's moments where she's like, you know, this is not how I saw this going, where I would meet a guy and have kids and he'd go and I'd find another guy and he'd go and she just says, and I'm tired of doing the same thing over and over and just seeing the rest of my life playing itself out. Like you watch it and you're like, yeah, I really feel for you in this moment because I've watched you go through all this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've watched you go from somebody who looks to be starting the second act of their life with such promise and end up making the same mistake. And you feel for her too. You can kind of see, like, you know, just with both Ethan Hawke and Arquette, there's more lines on their face as they get older. And you're like, you have earned every single one of those by raising these two children and being with the guys you've been with.
Yeah, I mean, at one point she says, I just feel like life is just nothing more than a series of events, failed events in her case. But then you look back and you say, no, you raised these two great kids. And for me, again, like I mentioned the moment where I kind of teared up, there's a side character, a very, very side character who comes back a few years later and says, look what I've become. And it's all because of you.
Yeah.
Oh
yeah.
I just get a little choked up. I don't know why I do. I even get a little choked
up. No, that moment got me too. It was kind of funny because the moment was like the film wasn't really reaching me on a deep, deep level. But that moment came along and I was like, oh, son of a bitch. You just got me.
Yeah. And cause it's in that moment that she kind of realizes, well, okay, I have made a positive I've done something positive in my life.
Yeah, it's an amazing movie. And we could be talking about it for 3 hours, I'll leave that for your show. I can't wait for half year to dig into this. That's for damn
right?
sure.
Yeah.
We do end with the souvenir, though. So if there was anything, any shot, any moment, any scene, any line that you could keep from Boyhood, I'm sure there are dozens, but what would be your souvenir from
It would definitely be the ending. Like the final shot.
Yeah.
I remember thinking, oh my God, please end right now.
Yeah.
And he does. And it's just, it gives me goosebumps every time because it's just so perfect. Yeah. What a way to end it.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just feel like that was the way to, it's not with a bang. It's not with a whimper. It's just where it should end.
Absolutely.
And I was so happy.
For me, it's a particular plot moment for me. When he's given an assignment by his photography teacher who, you know, sees what he's doing, he sees the promise he has, but he sees, he's having trouble just meeting regular deadlines. And he says, you're going to shoot the football game. I want you to go shoot the game, and I want you to bring me back 300 images, and I want them all tagged and ready to go for tomorrow. This is an assignment, because as much as you like doing it, you're not always going to like what you're doing, so I want you to be prepared to work. And when he goes to shoot the football game, he's still shooting his artsy stuff. Yeah. Like, he's shooting the netting, and he's shooting these really, really, like, artistic impressions of a football game. I really love that moment, because I've done that. I was going to say,
when Ryan McNeil is at a baseball game, yeah, he shoots a few pictures of the players, but there's a really interesting parking lot over there. This wall is amazing.
Yes. I'm at the stadium for half the day, even though the game is only 90 minutes or whatever. No, but I mean, even when I was younger too, I'd be given assignments like go shoot something for a yearbook or for the paper, for the school paper, and my stuff would come back. It was completely unusable. It was all this, look at this detail. It says so much. So that moment, I really latched onto that. So, well, we rate movies here on Matinee Cast on a scale of 1 to 4. I probably don't need to ask, but Andrew James, what do you give Richard Linklater's Boyhood?
Like a 4.5.
Yeah,
it's a strong 4. Definitely.
Funny thing for me, it's actually kind of a weak 4, and I haven't written about it yet. I'm going to be writing about this. Like, my post will go up by the time this goes. Fascinates me. It fascinates me on a deep, deep level, and I'm just like endlessly impressed by its audacity. As I've used that word already, but it didn't give me the same kind of lift that a lot of the movies that I give 4 stars to did. So it might even drop down to like a 3.5, which is not to say that it's bad. It's just to say that I don't think it's completely soaked in yet. It's been about a week. You've had like months to sit with this movie. So it might be the kind of thing where like I'm sitting like on a low 4, a high 3.5. It might be 3.5 by the time I write about it. But I'm just like, and not for anything bad, just that it didn't move me emotionally the way that a lot of 4-star films do.
I totally understand that. I super can't. It's opening here Friday. I'm going to the 11:30 a.m. screening. I'm dragging Emma to it. I'm super excited.
Awesome. I'd love to hear what people think about Boyhood. I really do want to hear people who don't like it. I want to hear why you don't like it. I promise I won't argue with you and tell you you're wrong. I'd love to hear why you didn't connect with it or whatnot, but let me know. Ryan@thematinee.ca, Twitter, where I'm matinee_CA, or facebook.com/darkmatinee. Come on back. We've got some kind of crazy choices for the other side to go with Boyhood right after this. Andrew's choice for the other side to go along with Boyhood was unexpected, to say the least. He went back to 1942, a film directed by David Hand and produced by Walt Disney. We're talking about Bambi here, folks. The plucky cartoon about the deer that grows up in the wild over the course of its young fawndom. Andrew, I could sort of guess, but I'm not entirely sure. Why are we discussing Bambi as your other side?
Yeah, well, you kind of mentioned it there in your brief summary of the movie. I asked, give me a direction for the B side. What do you think? And you said, you wrote back and said, probably like a coming of age thing. And I thought, I thought a coming of age, but that seems too obvious. And I couldn't come up with anything else, so I finally went onto Letterboxd, found somebody's list of coming of age films, and I'm flipping through, and boring. Bambi.
Huh.
That's interesting. That's totally a coming of age film, and I haven't seen it since I was like 4. So let's do that. Not to mention it's really short. It's like 70 minutes or something.
Yeah.
I've actually, over the last couple of years, I've been sort of going back to all these old Disney classics like Fox and the Hound and Snow White and really getting a kick out of them. So I thought, this is perfect. And as I'm watching it, it's kind of the same story as Boyhood. It just happens to be a deer experiencing life from childhood to adulthood.
And in the case of Bambi, there's the jump, right? Like we get Bambi as a child. And then we sort of get Bambi much older after like a cut.
Yeah, it does jump quite a few years.
But I'd actually, you know what? I'd never seen this properly. I think I'd seen a scene or two here or there, but I had seen so little of it that this was actually in my first dozen blind spot selections. So I only really first saw it proper like 2 years ago.
Okay.
I was, one of the things that caught me off guard about this movie was, holy cow, is this movie ever arty?
It's so arty. Like, everything is strokes, clear paintbrush strokes or clear drawing with a pencil. That's one of the things I really dig about it.
Oh, yeah. But I mean, not just in technique, although it is. Like, I do love that this is back when Disney films had a lot of paint on paper. But I just mean, even just in story and structure, like, I can only imagine if this movie were to come out now, audiences would be sitting there going, nothing happens. I'm watching bunnies, and then I'm watching skunks, and then, okay, oh, there's a fire. Okay, there's a fire. Oh, and now I'm watching rain, and now I'm watching skunks. Like, it's very abstract. It's a lot like those Disney movies they do now every March where it's like, watch the bears.
Well, it is 2 years after Fantasia,
right?
Which there was some clear influence, I think, because you're right. Like, there are shots of just leaves blowing around, or the snow, or butterflies, or whatever, and it was abstract.
Yeah,
totally. And the story is so simple.
Oh yeah, so yeah, exactly. It, you know, deer gets born, deer grows up.
Yeah, it's. I mean, there isn't even really that much to talk about, outside of, I don't know. I think, like, there's some interest for the 1940s, and I think Disney is famous for this. I mean, the single parenthood thing,
yeah.
And the other characters that he interacts with, like Flower,
the skunk.
I don't know. You might be able to interpret that character in certain ways that you might not otherwise. I don't want to go there. I just,
no. You know what? I wouldn't have thought about it back then. Hey, listen, for all I know, well, wait, is Flower
a boy? Let's just put it that way. But yeah, because at the end, he is Twitter-pated by a female skunk. But
okay. Yeah.
I was a little bit surprised to see that.
Yeah,
because,
I was going to say, like, you know, hey, listen, in 1942, that's progressive.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. I feel like that was a deliberate choice.
Yeah. I was actually sort of surprised that you picked it, because I know you and I have had one or two, oh, this is going to be another Guns Are Bad movie conversations. And I can think of few other Guns Are Bad movies than Bambi.
Yeah, totally. I mean, we're gonna segue into your B-side. It's kind of funny how there is some overlap, not only between Bambi and Boyhood, but between Bambi and your pick.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I don't think it's necessarily Guns Are Bad. Even though you never see them, it's clearly man is the bad guy, because of the fire, and yeah, you hear a lot of gunshots, but I think it's not a gun control movie. It's a human control movie. Yeah,
it's humans are assholes.
Yeah, totally it is.
Yeah, which is, it's crazy, because I do remember there was one of the AFI lists was 50 heroes, 50 villains, and one of the villains was from Bambi, and it was just like labeled as man from Bambi because the man kills the mama deer.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, they even in the beginning, I was surprised to see it. I didn't remember it, that they do have an encounter with man in the beginning that foreshadows later on. Like, they have to run earlier on too. And she talks about, I have to look into the meadow before I let you come out here because man is out there.
Yeah.
And it's like, she doesn't even explain what, like, I was waiting for Bambi to say, what is man? But he doesn't. She just says, man is out there. It's like this weird fog of evil that lurks out in the meadow, and you never see man in the movie. It's just this like concept more than a thing, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's like, I think the closest we get is like a silhouette or a shadow.
Yeah, and which, there's like a village or something.
Yeah, which for Disney is pretty restrained, because they really like freaking kids out.
Yeah,
especially back then.
I mean, that kind of makes it a little bit scarier, the way it's just described.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or not described. No, totally. As it were. Yeah.
Is it bad that I don't get weepy at this movie?
No, I don't either.
Okay.
I thought I totally would, but
yeah. It's not like I don't get misty at cartoons, because, like, I got all worked up watching both How to Train Your Dragon movies. I, you know, Toy Story 3 worked gangbusters on me. But for some reason, maybe it's just because it's so packaged up as this really, really sad experience. It just, it doesn't land for me. Like I don't even get Misty.
No, I didn't either. I was kind of having fun with it, laughing at a lot of it.
Now, that's a dick move.
Well,
you know, the only thing worse is if you could tell me that you were having venison for dinner while you were watching.
Well, my dad has said for years that he's always mad. Goddamn Bambi. That's the movie that made the deer overpopulation become a reality, because now nobody will go hunt Bambi's mom and Bambi's dad. And I mean, it's kind of tongue in cheek when he says it, but, you know,
sure
it's. Yeah. I don't know. I didn't get too broken up about it either. Maybe it's because it's just, it is so, like you said, it's packaged up, but it's so short and simple. You never really attach yourself to the character really deeply like you do with something like Toy Story.
Yeah.
I don't know, but no, I didn't find it all that sad either. And it's coming. You've known it since you were
Four. Three. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
and that's, you know, it's funny that you mentioned that it's 70 minutes. It gets in, gets out. 'Cause I think that for me was the really, really, crazy thing. Like, even, you know, now a lot of cartoons, they go 80, 90, 100 minutes. Some of them even, you know, find the stones to go up to 2 hours. But for this movie, that's been so revered, to do what it needs to do in like an hour and 10. Right. Mm-hmm. Like, hell, there are some TV shows that can't even get done what they need to get done in an hour and 10. You know what? The season finale of Game of Thrones was 59.
Yeah.
Right. This is 70. That's amazing to me that it gets so much beauty and emotion and all that. And like you say, and coming of age and maturity and that into an hour and 10 minutes.
And I suppose at the time they figured this is the attention span of a kid, and so we're going to make it work for a kid.
Yeah, probably.
Yes, and there are moments that maybe aren't tearful, but there's moments that are kind of scary. Like there's the scene where the Bucks are fighting,
yeah,
and it goes all Lion King. It gets very black, and then they're pink. And then they're angry red, and then they're yellow. It's very
very arty, like I'm saying.
It's very arty, yeah. But in a, you know, with a clear intent, a visual intent to sort of aggravate you or maybe make kids scared.
Maybe. And this is the thing. Like again, Disney was good at that back in the day, and mm-hmm. I kind of feel like we got away from that. And you know, it really helped. I've said this a few times. Kids need to be scared.
Oh, absolutely.
And if you can do it and still show them that it's going to be okay, still show them that, you know, the skunks find other little skunks and the deer has, you know, has his moments, everything's going to be okay, that you know, you help kids deal with fear better. Well, this was your choice. So, if for some wacky reason somebody else out there is like me and has never seen Bambi, what is the ultimate, like, takeaway? What's the marry up, either just to throw it on for the heck of it or to move on to it after Boyhood?
I did really like the artiness of it. Not only, like you said, in the sort of abstract weird, but I really enjoy looking at and appreciating the craft that went into this. I mean, 70 minutes is short.
Yeah.
But not when you're hand drawing every single frame.
No.
Like, it's amazing. And it looks so good. Like, they didn't just draw a skunk. I mean, there's gorgeousness going on in the background. There's some great artistry throughout the whole thing. I mean, that's what I took away from it now at age almost 40, is just really enjoying the craft and the look of the movie. Like, Bambi doesn't even talk that much. There's a few lines of dialogue, but mostly it's just, this is what you see on screen and enjoy it.
Yeah. Isn't like the first thing he says is bird, isn't it?
Yes.
Oh, burr. Burr. Burr.
Yeah, burr. And the thumper, who's kind of a jackass the whole movie, constantly correcting him, telling him how shitty he is at walking. And
now, if this was your show, that would be the title of the episode.
Thumper's a jackass.
Yes, I might even add that in. Well, we've got one more movie for you, so come back after this. We're going to talk about one more film and close out the show. So I'm a loser, baby. my choice of The Other Side, I chose a movie which I had not yet seen. I went back to 1991 and played the director connection. I went to Richard Linklater's arrival on the scene as a movie maker. I went to Slacker, which I'd love to tell you what this movie's about, but it's not really about anything. Much like Bambi in Boyhood, it makes for a perfect little marry-up. It's just a wandering movie around Austin, Texas in 1991, meeting a whole bunch of weirdos and misfits and all the crazy people that make up Austin, Texas in the early 90s, and just spending time with each one of these people and then moving on to another one. You must have seen this before.
No, I'm so glad that you really haven't seen it, because I haven't seen it either.
Okay. How did you notice? I felt like I was the last person to see this movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's a Criterion. It's borderline cult classic now. Not borderline. It is. I mean, yeah, I would think everybody's seen. No, it's just one of those blind spots. I think I was looking over Linklater's filmography, and outside of like, there's a documentary about a coach, and then his short stuff. I think now that I've seen this, I've seen everything he's done, or everything he's directed, anyway. That's cool.
This is actually in your Library of Congress. Did you know that?
I did not. Yeah. That's kind of weird.
That's kind of crazy, isn't it?
I don't totally agree with you that it's not about anything. I'm not sure I can succinctly or accurately paint what it's about, but it is clearly, to me, about the how mankind is totally doomed. Like, it's everybody there's serial killers numerous times mentioned, child abductions mentioned, those posters, the missing child posters keep popping up in the background. Everybody is kind of an asshole to each other. Nobody really cares about what the other people are saying. And it's always about bleak things and about how giving up on humanity. The old guy talking about, he's basically given up on humanity. I think he says that quote, that line for line. And the movie ends with a kid like throwing a camera off of a cliff, and then you see what the camera is capturing, and it's totally a black downward spiral
right
into the abyss to cut to blackness in the credits. To me, the whole movie was humanity's going to hell in a handbasket.
Yeah. Now, on the one hand, like, that really, like, Slacker, after this movie, Slacker, like, really, really kind of took off in the lexicon. This is kind of one thing where I'm happy that even though I didn't see this movie, I'm right in the age bracket for this particular movie. I know a lot about the kind of people who this movie are portraying, and what, like, was going on in society at the time, and what would come, too, because you know, you guys are doing the 1984 project, but in 1994, there was a lot of crazy shit going on. Like, 94 was the year of things like the Menendez brothers and O.J. Simpson. Like, this whole era was like the Menendez brothers and Lorraine Bobbitt and all these just crazy, crazy stories that were taking on international attention. And I kind of feel like that was the thing, was at this time, with all these really, really messed up bits of news and humanity, that people just started saying, we're screwed, you know, and they just started saying, well, I could do something about it, but, you know, why bother? We're screwed.
Yeah, I totally think that's exactly what's going on in this movie.
Yeah.
It's
kind of funny, because it made me think, like, I'm looking through this whole movie and I just keep thinking, Jesus, we were dicks in the 90s.
Yeah.
All of us.
I don't feel like, I mean, I don't think it's an accurate portrayal of everybody in the 90s.
No.
It's just that this particular film kind of focuses on those people.
Yeah.
I don't think it's an accurate focus of people now. I mean, we have the internet, and if you go to any comment section on some random site,
yeah,
it is these people. Like, it's just all trolls fighting about whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, not any website, but, you know, like the big ones, like if you go into an IMDb board or whatever.
Right.
That's what you get, or a YouTube video or something. But I don't think it's bleak and it's terrible, but I don't think it's really an accurate description of how most people feel.
No. Now, the other crazy thing about this movie that kind of makes it a good marry-up for me with Boyhood is it also marks the time. Like, if somebody wanted me to describe 1991 to them, in 50 words or less, I'd say, well, just watch Slacker. You know, that really, really sums up life for 20-somethings in 1991 and deals a lot with what was going on in the world and what we were thinking about it. But unlike Boyhood, it doesn't really seem to be – it has no enthusiasm about what's going on in the world. Like Boyhood, as it's going along, is kind of almost celebrating a lot of the cool stuff that we were coming up with and a lot of the cool stuff that was being created. You know, even right down to like when they're talking about like new Star Wars movies and when he's talking about like going to watch his baseball team play and they're having a good year. But that's the thing. All of the talk about 1991 in Slacker is about what was wrong with the world in 91.
Yeah.
So.
And where it's going. And I don't know, as a like on a technical note, I found any of the moments where there were two characters talking to like having a conversation.
Yeah.
I really tuned out. Whenever the moment was a character just babbling on and on about something, okay. I found it really interesting. So there's the guy going on about all the weird FBI government conspiracies. There's the old guy who just goes on and on about how he just wants to blow shit up and he loves it when guys climb up on towers and just shoot people randomly. There's the guy in the library talking about the JFK conspiracy stuff. Like anytime a guy is just babbling on and on about something they're really passionate – I found it kind of interesting to watch or fun to watch.
What about Teresa Taylor trying to push Madonna's pap smear?
Right. Yeah. That was so weird.
That might be the weirdest thing I've seen in a movie in a long time.
When she comes up to those two characters having an interaction, that interaction is painful because I feel like it's supposed to be ad-libbed and those people are horrible at ad-libbing. Like it feels like the start of a porno or something. Not that I watch porn. But you know, it just felt really, this is terrible. This is terrible filmmaking. Cut this out. And then she shows up and kind of injects some energy to it. But
yeah. What, now you said you had a connection between Slacker and Bambi.
Oh, and that was Mankind is the asshole.
Yeah, well, yeah.
That was the connection I found.
Oh, yeah. Oh, totally. Like, it's kind of funny because being the age I am now, I like to pick on hipsters with their like ironic and very ambivalent detachment from a lot of things. But then I think, you know, my generation wasn't really that much better.
Yeah. I mean, Emma popped in a couple times while I was watching it and the word hipster came out of her mouth a couple times.
Yeah.
I mean, it totally is. Hipsters of the 90s.
It's exactly what it was. And they didn't dress as well.
Right.
You know, it's hipsters without the style is what it is.
Oh,
well, one of the other reasons why I wanted to watch this movie, and like, I gotta be honest, I didn't like it. Like, I don't know if this is the kind of movie somebody likes. Like you said, you kind of dug it. That's kind of the reaction I thought. Yeah. But you know, for all I know, this movie has fans. But what I dug about it, one of the reasons I'm happy I watched it, is Linklater as a director, for me, is just endlessly fascinating because he has made movies that I have adored to the hills. He has made movies that have pissed me off. And I never know. And he's made movies that have just, you know, bored the heck out of me. I never know what I'm going to get when I sit down. And I could be jacked to no end. I could be, oh, great, it's a new Linklater movie, and I loved his last two or three. This is going to be awesome. And I just watch it, and my jaw just hits the floor at how pissed off I am. Like, I actually walked out away. I actually walked away angry from Fast Food Nation, which was one of his movies. I walked away befuddled from A Scanner Darkly, which I know your co-host adores. But meanwhile, I was like brimming with happiness from movies like Bernie and Before Midnight and obviously Boyhood and, you know, God knows, Dazed and Confused. So in that way, I kind of like him a lot more than some of my favorite directors like Spielberg and Scorsese and Steven Soderbergh because I don't know what I'm getting into.
That's so... encapsulates how I feel about him too. Like, he is one of my new favorite. Whenever somebody says who's your favorite director, list off the obvious and then throw in Richard Linklater, because even if there's a few movies I don't really care for that much,
yeah,
they're doing something interesting and new and fresh, and even if it doesn't always work, it's still something you haven't seen before probably.
Yeah.
Or at least tackling something that you hadn't pondered before. So
yeah. No, and
So when you walk away angry from Fast Food Nation, he did his job.
No.
Not in that case?
Not to digress too much, but what happened with that was he was actually selling me. I don't know if he is a vegetarian or not. I don't even know if he cares. But he was actually selling me on the whole idea of eating less fast food and even just eating less meat, period, and the fact that it spawns so many bad things. And then I don't really give a crap about giving this away, but the movie ends with a long shot that watches the food, like your meat getting processed at a plant. And it's the gut shot to the end and then cut to black. Like if that had been in the middle, it probably would have sealed his argument. I would have had time to come down and take it all in at once and probably feel like I needed to make a change. But it was like spiking the ball to me, and I was so ticked. I went across the street and had Burger King just to spite Richard Linklater and Fast Food Nation. But, awesome. You know, here we are. Yeah, here we are 8 years later, and it's still stuck in my brain. You know, much as I hated that experience, I wasn't bored.
Right.
You know?
And same thing with Scanner Darkly. I'm as perplexed as you on that film. I only saw it the one time and didn't totally get it. Didn't really even enjoy it all that much because I didn't really get it. But, wow, I don't think I've seen anything like it ever before or ever since. So, yeah.
No, it's nuts. It's crazy. And that's the thing. I really, really appreciate that in Richard Linklater and his work. And you know, he will always have my attention. He absolutely, especially now that Steven Soderbergh is gone, because he would do that too. You know, like he would drop something like Full Frontal in your lap and you'd be like, well, I don't really know what to make of that, but okay. That's where Linklater comes in now that there's no Soderbergh directing film.
Yeah, I mean, while I was watching Slacker, one of the things I was trying to do is put myself in the headspace of going to see an indie film in 1991, unknown director. And it is, I mean, maybe there's stuff before it that was like this, but I can't think of too many where it just, there is no story. You follow this person for a little while until they meet up with somebody else, and then you follow them for a little while, and then they meet up with somebody else, you follow them, and it's an hour and a half of that, and I can just feel myself thinking about, wow, this is revolutionary at the time.
Yeah,
it's really, and it does feel like Schizopolis in a lot of ways.
Yeah,
like Soderbergh's Schizopolis.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy because the other one I was thinking about was because I've been watching a bit of Spike Lee movies. As I was thinking about Do the Right Thing.
Oh yeah, it's kind of similar to that.
In a way, and that's my takeaway, is sometimes when you get a film that encapsulates its time, sometimes you had to be there. And if you were, you'll get more from it than if you weren't. Other times, like, you could be looking at it and it could be like, oh, wow, I didn't really think about this, about life in the 90s. But if you were there, you kind of get that much more from it.
Agreed.
So there we go. Slacker. If you haven't seen it, like, it's an interesting watch. I'd be curious to find people who watch it for the first time and enjoy it, because I don't really think it's that kind of movie. But it's certainly an interesting study, if nothing else.
Agree. Yeah, absolutely it is.
Nice. Well, that is episode 117 of the Matinee Cast. Come on back on Monday, August the 4th. For episode 118, we're going to be talking about Guardians of the Galaxy. Andrew, of course, can be heard on the Row 3 Cinecast, though not on the next episode we were talking about before we rolled tonight. He's actually taken an episode off for the first time in many years. Not even many episodes.
I think
years.
I missed one or two. I can actually see Kurt and Matt are both online right now on Skype. So I think they're recording the episode on Rise of the Planet of the Apes as we speak.
Nice. Anything at all you guys are going to be talking about Boyhood probably the same week that this drops on your next Cinecast, I'm sure
next week we'll definitely be diving into this,
so tune into that. Like, I'm going to put the over under you guys are, that's a 3-hour show.
It's got to be.
I'm
willing to talk about it.
The thing that might hold you back is you're not talking about television.
Right.
You guys talk about a show, that's where you clock it upwards.
It gets long.
Yeah. Like,
we're going
like
to be doing...
Like last time, the boys were talking about Louis a week or two ago, and that was what added to your runtime.
Yeah, whenever they talk about Louis, I usually take my headphones off and play a couple video games, come back. And you mentioned we're doing the 1984 project, so the next one that we're doing is 2010, A Space Odyssey.
Ah, cool. And if people want to follow you on Twitter, where can they find you?
Andrew_James.
Very nice. My site is thematinee.ca. For more audio content, you can find back episodes by going to thematinee.ca/podcasting. You can also find them on Blueberry. Oh, you can help me with this. What's the app? What's a good app if somebody wants to follow the show for Android?
Podcasts?
For Android.
There's several, but the one I always gone back to is called Podkicker.
There we go. Find me on Podkicker. Apple has a podcasting app. You can find me there. And I'm also on Stitcher Radio. For now, you can still find the show on SoundCloud, but I think that that's a lost cause. So that might be done. The iTunes Store, of course, you can subscribe and get new episodes when they drop. I'd also love feedback if you wouldn't mind dropping me a comment there. Help me raise the profile of the show. Speaking of feedback, any of your thoughts on Boyhood, Bambi, or Slacker can be left in the comment section of the site. Emailed to ryan@thematinee.ca, Twitter, where I'm matinee_ca, or Facebook, facebook.com/darkmatinee. Any final thoughts, sir?
I have got to go do some finals, so no.
Okay, done. For Andrew, I'm Ryan. We'll see you at the matinee.